Welcome to Lemme Works, brought to you by Leadership Education Mentoring Institute.
We are inspiring parents, mentors, and communities as they embark on the journey of transformational project-based education.
Hi, this is Tatiana Fallon.
Hi, this is Heidi Christensen. We're so excited to be your hosts. Hi, everyone. I am so excited to have Cassie Dixon and Camille McCausland here with me. They are both Pyramid Project trainers, and we are going to do something that a lot of people have asked me about, and we're going to be talking. First of all, we're going to have a book colloquium on one of the Pyramid Project suggested readings for the scholars, and that's Carry On, Mr. Bowditch. But we're also going to talk about how do we prepare for colloquiums with our scholars. And so why don't we start with that? Can you guys just let me know, how do you guys prepare? What do you start by doing?
For me, as a mentor, of course, the first thing would be reading the book and doing what I actually ask the scholars when they're reading their book to underline anything that kind of hits them, you know, that is interesting to them or that they think is meaningful. It doesn't have to be what someone else thinks is meaningful, right? So it's what they're getting out of it. And to make note of any words that they don't understand, that they're not sure the meaning of, and they can look them up. There's different ways that people do that while they're reading. I like to do it. Sometimes I don't like to interrupt the flow of my reading. And so I'll just make a note. I'll write the word down in the back of the book. A lot of my books just have vocabulary words in the back of them on the very inside of the back cover. And I put a page number so that I can go back and read it in context and then look it up so that I really understand the meaning of the word. And there are some words in Carry On, Mr. Bowditch that might be new for the scholars. Some of them were new for me the first time I mentored Pyramid Project. So definitely reading the book in the way that you're expecting your scholars to do it, and inviting them to do this in a way that's going to engage them. So they're going to be thinking about what they're reading, and also inviting them to apply what they're reading or looking for the principles. Every project, not just Pyramid Project, but every project has certain principles that we're talking about all the time in class. And so I invite them to look for those principles, you know, so looking for something that shows patterns or and original sources. Help me out here, Cassie, with the pyramid principles. So they're looking for those.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything that Camille has said. As far as when I'm preparing my scholars for a colloquium, I'll have them underline, you know, words or phrases that stick out to them. And sometimes, you know, scholars at the beginning of a book, they'll be like, they may say something like, oh, well, I know all the words, or there's not going to be something there. But I guarantee it that with this book, especially with Carry On, Mr. Bowditch, that we're going to be discussing, there's going to be some words and phrases and some metaphors that are used that they're not going to know. And so we're going to be able to bring that out with them in hopes that they've underlined it previously or beforehand when we do come together for the colloquium. But another thing that I always ask our scholars to do is to come prepared with their questions and to come prepared with something to present the group with. So like if there's a question that they have about what they read, they should come prepared with that question, but then also a question that they want to ask of the group. And so we always ask them to have at least a one-to-one. So a question that they are curious about, that they want to know more about, and then a question that they're going to pose to the group.
Oh, I love that. So you must be taking some time to talk to them about annotating their books.
Yeah.
Beforehand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you tell them? So you're telling them to underline things, and, you know, it sounds like Camille, you were saying to put words that they don't know and underline phrases and things like that. Is there any other things that you would have them do? How do you teach them this?
Excuse me. I think for every student that can look different. For instance, I had a scholar that she really liked using the small sticky note things that you can use to find pages. And she would come to colloquium with like tons of these in her book. So she could turn and she'd have a little word or a phrase on those that would help her to know what that one was about, what that sticky note was you know, that page had something on it about that. And so she would have something she could contribute to the discussion. Hopefully by the time they're in Pyramid Project, they've had enough colloquia that they know how this is going to roll. But there still are some scholars who, you get them in a group and they're like, they feel like they have nothing to share. And I think that's one of the skills that a good mentor, you kind of have to learn that, how to help the scholars see that whatever they might have to say, a lot of times they'll say, oh, well, I was going to say that, you know, that somebody else just said, that's what I was thinking. So I don't really have anything. Well, but tell us about what your thoughts are about it, because we all have a different perspective on that. And it's not like now you can't share about that because someone else shared about that. So it's okay to start in a colloquium with a question about what was your favorite part of the book, but maybe everybody in the circle, maybe that was all of them said that was their favorite part of the book. And so they feel like, well, there's nothing for me to share. So we start with that maybe, but we want to branch out from there, you know? What was it that affected you? Everyone here is so different and we can see things differently. And even if the scholar didn't like the book, sometimes that's a great, I've had great discussions, right, Cassie? Have you had any where a student says, I hated this book, I couldn't stand it?
Yeah. I think that happens often. And so when it does happen, I always pose back or present back to them, well, what was it that you didn't like about it? Let's have a discussion about this, you know, just to get them kind of exploring and seeing different perspectives, because guaranteed, I think there's going to be someone else in the group that might either share something similar or slightly different. And then they may actually, in turn, what I have found, they go in not liking a book and then they discover more things about themselves, more things about the book, more things about their peers, to where they're like, actually, I guess I do kind of like the book. I didn't realize that before, you know? And so they discover more about themselves. So even if they come in saying they didn't like the book, I think they walk away actually liking it.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. I love how you're trying to help them learn more about themselves. It isn't just about the content in the book. It's also about, you know, learning about themselves and applying those lessons to themselves. Yeah. That's awesome.
I think maybe one of the rookie mistakes that mentors make is we get excited, right? Because we're reading this book and we see so many things and we want to share our perspective with the scholars. And I think it's okay to do a little of that, but this is their discussion. We're meant to be more of a facilitator and someone who is drawing out from them what they're thinking and helping them all in the group to understand that we don't all have to think the same. We all have our own amazing thoughts. And so it's just important to kind of set that kind of a tone with them and to realize that as a mentor, we're not going to try to lead the discussion in a certain path for them to come to the same conclusions we came to, but just to ask questions mostly. Questions are what get our brain thinking. You know, just stating a fact doesn't really, or what we might think is a fact, isn't going to get other people thinking. It might be interesting information. Sometimes people say something and it's stated as fact, and I think it's interesting and I write it down. But we're trying to get them to think, right? To learn how to think, not what to think. So if we want to get them to learn how to think, we need to ask some questions. And it's good for us to come up with questions, not that are informational quiz type questions, like which character in the book did this? You know, we're not testing them. These should be questions that are very open-ended, not yes or no questions, but questions where they're going to have to be thinking more deeply. And maybe even just getting the ball rolling again, where we're using the principles, these principles that we're trying to teach, and asking them, where did they see this particular principle? Or which habits of a scientist did you see in the book? Or which Georgics principles did you find here? Whatever, you know, project it may be. And so we're getting them to think by asking them questions and looking for principles. I think also if we can help them to kind of apply. We definitely want them to apply mm-hmm. things that they're passionate about, whatever really inspired them in the book. And which is why, for me, a question similar to, like, you know, how has this book changed you? Or what was there in the book that really inspired you? In what way did it inspire you? You know, just what I was sharing earlier with you ladies about my son in this very ragged book that's falling apart. I found my son's notes, things he had written in the margins, and what he had written helped me to kind of see what he was thinking about at the age of about 13. He had written by the table of contents, "Nat is a scholar," in bold letters with an exclamation mark. So I can see from that there was something in this book that made him feel like being a scholar is something he wants to be, was something he aspired to be. And we refer to our students as scholars. So that really touched me when I saw that.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Now, Cassie, I know you have now moved into the actual public school mm-hmm. classroom. I think that is so awesome. Have you seen any differences? Because I think people would be interested in that.
Well, I use a lot of the LEMI principles and things and the mentoring principles that I've learned within our Commonwealth and with leadership education. I actually bring a lot of that into my classroom because I want to be able to strengthen, you know, my kids' critical thinking skills. And I want them to be able to think. Camille had said, you know, we're trying to teach them how to think, not what to think. And so I do also find myself balancing, kind of holding back and not sharing my perspective, but asking those really good questions, you know, like, oh, that's really interesting. Why do you think that way? Like, what does this mean for you or for your peers? Or have you ever had an experience that was similar to what just took place in the book? And so I'm applying a lot of those, the same type of, I guess, methodology, the pedagogy, I guess, as far as asking those really good questions. Because I think it's when we ask those questions, like, you know, Camille was saying, is when we really help them to deepen their understanding of the material that they've read, that they're able to dig deeper and to really strengthen their own, you know, critical thinking skills, but also it helps them to discover more about themselves, right, and the world around them. And so I've used a lot of those even within my own practices teaching in the public school. Now I can control that, you know, I can't speak the same for other teachers, how they do it in their classrooms, but I want to, you know, as best I can anyway, try to increase the level of the critical thinking of these deep thinkers that are going to be going out into the real world eventually to be able to think on their own and not be told what's fed to them either, you know, by media, social media, you know, by someone else, especially our college bound kids, right? If they're, you know, they're going to be going to school at some point, they need to be able to think on their own and not just regurgitate what a teacher, professor, instructor is kind of telling them. But yeah, again, I think it just boils down to asking those really, really good questions and then having them explore more, right? So, oh, well, tell me more about that, you know, and getting them to feed to you what it is that they're thinking and why they're thinking that, making sure it's a safe place for them to do so. Cause there's kids that'll kind of hold back and not want to share. And I'll be like, no, it's okay. Go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say. And so, yeah. So anyway, I think it really does boil down to asking those really good, solid, deep thinking type of questions.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, why don't we go into actually talking about the book? So why do we have our scholars read this book for Pyramid Project?
Well, this book in particular shows a character, Nathaniel Bowditch, who does what I love any good book to do, and he evolves, he changes, he grows, and most importantly, his passion for mathematics and learning, really the science of navigation, it continues to motivate him through many, many challenges. So one of the habits of a scientist that we talk about in Pyramid Project is having the heart of a scientist. and being able to, when we come up against a challenge, to just push beyond it, you know, and not let that undermine us, and to challenge assumptions. So a lot of the principles, I mean, this book is so perfect for seeing a lot of the principles and the habits of a scientist that we teach to our scholars, our pyramid scholars. What do you think, Cassie?
Yeah, so I was just taking notes because you just said something with Nathaniel Bowditch, he had this love of learning, right? Like this passion for learning. And it wasn't just, you know, that, I mean, of course he loved math, right? And he loved science, but I think he had that love of learning. And so I love this book because it goes into the phases of learning that we talk about, right? And so he had that desire to actually learn the math, to go and learn on his own, you know? And when he's in grade school, you know, he goes to his teacher who's, you know, asks for a harder math problem. And he's like, oh no, why is that too hard? You know, and he's like, no, I need another math problem because it was too easy, right? He was like self-taught and just had this desire to learn more that I think he amazed or surprised a lot of those around him, you know, because he had this deep-rooted love for learning. And so I just wanted to point that out when Camille said that, because it was not just he liked math, I think he loved to learn. And then his desire for that math and for, you know, learning the things that he did came because of his love for learning.
You know, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that is one of our basic principles in a leadership education, a foundation of a love of learning. And that needs to continue all through our lives, or we would hope it would anyway. And for me, one of the most inspiring parts of the book was when Nat was wanting to read Isaac Newton's Principia. Mm-hmm. And so his friend and mentor, that's another thing to look for in that book, is there are mentors, and then he becomes a mentor. But anyway, this mentor of his allows him access to this library of books. Suggests, well, you want to learn about the stars and navigation? The first place would seem to be Newton's Principia. So he hands him this book, and Nat looks at it, and he's like, oh boy, this is in Latin. I don't know Latin. Well, most of us, I think, would be like, never mind, I guess. You know, and nowadays we could just say, well, I'm going to go Google an English translation of Isaac Newton's Principia, which we can do, right? We do that now. But he couldn't do that then. So he had to learn the Latin or not read Newton's work. And he decided he was going to learn Latin, and his way of approaching it, where he would, if I recall, help me out, Cassie, but I think he used a Bible next to
He did. Yeah.
He would just, and a Latin, what do they call it? Anyway, where he could look up the meanings of words.
Didn't he have two Bibles, one in the foreign language he was learning and one in English?
Yeah. And he was actually reading, I think, from Genesis, I think is what he was reading from. And he was, you know, like that first part where in the beginning, the word was God. And so he used that side by side comparison. And he's like, oh, I just learned three words, you know, like, and so he was even amazed that reading that side by side, he's like, oh, Principia. Oh, well, that's in the beginning. Oh, so then that must mean for Newton's book, this is in the beginning of, you know, like what he's doing and what he's, you know, was creating with his book. And so, yeah. I just love that he was so driven to learn things on his own, that he was resourceful, right? Like he sought out things, but if he didn't know it, he's like, well, I'm going to learn Latin because by golly, I'm going to read this book, Principia by Isaac Newton, right?
And here's where, you know, you can ask your scholars, in what way have you been inspired to do something that maybe you haven't thought about really doing before? Because you've read this book, like how has this book inspired you? And get them really thinking. And I just want to interject something here, kind of going back to leading a colloquium, that mentors need to get more okay with an uncomfortable silence. If we're going to give them a hard question to consider something that's deep, we need to give them the time to think about it and not feel like, well, I guess nobody's answering the question, so we'll just move on. You know, allow them time to think about these difficult questions. We've grappled with a lot of this before we step into the colloquium, but they have not. Most of them have not.
That's a good point. Yeah. And a lot of, you know, even with my scholars, you know, in my previous Commonwealth, I mean, a lot of them sometimes are slow processors. Sometimes I'm a slow processor, right? Like my mind takes some time to have to formulate an answer in my brain. And so I think that's a very good point, Camille, that you've brought out for sure, being comfortable with silence.
Yeah, no, I know in trainings, I will usually tell people, okay, count to 10 or count to like 20. And if somebody hasn't said anything, take a deep breath and count to 20 again. Just to something to do while you're sitting in the silence sometimes helps. So.
There are things you can do so that scholars will come and they can feel like they already have something they can share, because it's quite common for a lot of the scholars to feel like they don't have anything worth sharing. They have things to share, but then they feel like, well, maybe that's something stupid, or that person just said something so profound. I don't have anything really profound. I mean, maybe they just wanted to share that they thought this one place in the book was really funny, you know, but that's okay. I love humor. So share the funny part with me. Why was that funny to you? You know, so sometimes if you have a way, if you can use ways to get them to engage with the book enough that they can actually have something to share before they ever come. One of the things that I've done before is I'll say, bring something to our colloquium tomorrow or next week or whatever that is representative of something in the book that you enjoyed or that inspired you or whatever, you know. So they bring an object and we put it right in the middle of our circle. And I always set up our colloquia as a circle because I feel like that way we're all equal. We're sharing equally. We all have things that are great to share and we can see each other. Right, we can see pretty much everyone when you're in a circle. So we put those things in the middle of the circle and they can pick it up and talk about why they brought that and why it, you know, what it reminds them of in the book and what it represents for them.
Oh, that is such a good idea. I love that. I love that. That is really cool. One of the things that I noticed in Nathaniel Bowditch is that yes, he loves learning. And Cassie, I love how you brought out where you can actually see the different phases where, you know, and he has mentors and he becomes a mentor. What is something that you try every single time to share with students? Is there anything that you really try and bring out, or that's more important than other things in the book? Or is it just what the kids like? Is it just purely the kids?
I think for me, it's a combination of both. I think we always start off by having them kind of start the discussion. You know, what was it that they found interesting, or what questions do they have? What do they want to talk about? I always open it up first, but then I do kind of, I mean, as we're facilitating, there's one thing that we do try to bring out, and that is the capacity triangle. We actually use this myself and a previous mentor when we mentored the class, would discuss this concept of the capacity triangle and how that applies to Nathaniel Bowditch. Because with the capacity triangle, it talks about, you know, your character, increasing your character, increasing your competence. And there's a couple of things that happen in the book where I think it was his first wife, Elizabeth, well, she wasn't his wife at the time, but had made a comment to him about how he's always stumbling upon people's dumbness. And so we use this in the from the book to kind of elaborate on the capacity triangle, on the concept of the capacity triangle, to kind of get the kids to understand, you know, the character that Nat had versus his competence. Because he clearly was a smart guy, right? I mean, he was self-taught and he had this desire to learn math and science and wrote his own book and did all these things, found the errors, right? Which led to him writing his own book. And so we talk about, you know, how he was very intelligent, but his character was sort of lacking in some areas. And so we kind of, you know, bring this out to the scholars and then have them kind of discuss, you know, ways that he could have improved his character, or what that means for him in relation to his competence and his intelligence. I don't know, Camille, if there's something that you bring out personally.
Well, that's one of my favorite things. And just for those people who aren't familiar with the capacity triangle, if you think of a triangle, so a right triangle, and you Can you see my hands? So yeah. Pretend there's that hypotenuse there, that other line. One of these, and it doesn't matter which one of these is character, one of them is competence. And as you increase both of those, they may not be even for any of us, but then that area becomes bigger. But if even if you have a lot of, let's say this is character, if you have a lot of character, but you don't have very much competence, then the area, you know, if you draw that imaginary line, that area of that triangle is not, is it's skinny, it's tall, but it's not going to be as large as if you have a lot of competence and a lot of characters. Same thing, you may have a lot of really good competence, but very little character. And then you still don't have as much capacity to influence others and do good in the world. Mm-hmm. So that, in case you didn't know, that's the capacity triangle. And I in particular, Cassie, I love that too, because like I said before, for me in a classic, for me to enjoy it, I need to see an evolving of a character in their character and their competence. And they change, because that's real. That's what people do. We change as we go through life, hopefully for the better, right? We learn and we grow. And so we see this change in that, and we can ask the scholars, where did you see him go from being someone who was very intelligent and knew all this stuff and he knew how to do things, but he would get angry with people that didn't understand what he thought was just simple stuff to understand. And, you know, that can be quite offensive to some of us. We don't always have the, you know, book on navigation for dummies or whatever. And so we see Nat, the scholars do see Nat progressing in his character to the point where he's now patient. He's developed patience with the other crew members, and he's mm-hmm. decided he thinks they all could do what he's doing. So he teaches them, and he makes note of how to explain it to people in a way that they'll understand.
Oh, I love that.
So it's not just all of the complicated jargon that he understands, but he would write down how he explained it to this person that didn't know all that he knew, and they got it, you know. So he'd make a note of that. Here's a good way to explain this to other people. To me, that was amazing.
Yeah,
I love that.
And just to tag on to that too, or to add on to what Camille was saying, one of the questions, you know, as we're kind of facilitating with our scholars, is what was Nat really good at, you know, and what did he have trouble with? And so we use that again in relation to the capacity triangle, because sometimes the scholars, they want to, you know, they can be fixated on thinking that, well, he was really smart, he was really intelligent, he had nothing left to learn because he was self-taught and he did all these things. And so, you know, through our discussion and through, you know, helping them see a different perspective, they do discover that, oh, he really did have a lot to learn as far as social skills and interacting with people. And like Camille was saying, he, you know, he was in a position where he had to be patient with the other crew members and teaching them what he knew. And so that was still a very critical skill for him to be able to learn and grow as a person. You know, and so I love using these kind of questions and applying the capacity triangle, because there's so many different angles to it. It's not just about intelligence, right? There's so many ways that we can still learn and grow in our own person and our own development ourselves. So
yeah. We're interrupting this episode to invite you to ask questions or share your epiphanies in the comment section.
And if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving us a good review on the platform you are using, because that really helps others find our content.
Also, check out our website at lemmyhomeschool.com.
Thank you. Yeah. I do want to take just a second to welcome Leah Hone. Leah is one of our newest Lemmy trainers, and she is going to be a pyramid trainer as well. So thank you for being able to hop on, Leah. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had that in my calendar wrong. But just in what you guys were talking about right now, what came to mind is like personality tests, because oftentimes like we'll do a personality test, and like bringing that in when I think about like Nat and like his personality, like so oftentimes for them to understand I feel like for us to understand like our scholars, and also for them to understand how to navigate like relationships and understand these things and people, kind of like how Elizabeth kind of understood that in him. to recognize like the personality types that they might generally represent. So I like in the beginning of the semester, like kind of having them take a personality test and being able to recognize that as we go through these like book discussions and discuss how like that's not always, I mean, part of it's like a character flaw, but also it's part of understanding like our personalities and personalities of others and kind of trying to like help our scholars in understanding them and like where they're, you know, might not be character flaw as much as like this is a personality thing where they're not seeing themselves a certain way or not seeing others a certain way, and just being able to help them out and help them understand like that and like recognize that in these characters.
Yeah. Personality tests are really, they're just seeing patterns in people. And that's really what Pyramid, that's a foundational thing in Pyramid. So I love that seeing that in these different characters in the books that you read is fantastic. So yeah. Thank you.
I love that. And I think for me, one of the interesting parts in this book was how Nat did evolve more in his social aptness, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. I often wonder when I read about these great people, artists, scientists, mathematicians, if many of them aren't what we would say were on the spectrum, because they're so, I don't know, they don't pick up social cues very well, and they really have to struggle to learn how to connect with other people. But one of the things that really showed me that Nat evolved was when he becomes a captain. He had been serving under Captain Prince, was his name, if I'm remembering right. But then he becomes a captain, and he didn't really understand why Captain Prince would just, this way that he would act when he was on the ship, but when they weren't on the ship, when they would finally get to land or before they'd get on the ship, it was almost like he was a whole different person. He was very lighthearted and happy. But I'll just read this little part in the book, because this was a point in time when Nat learned something about people. He said, "For the first time, he began to understand Captain Prince, the set of his jaw and the bite of his words when a voyage began, the eternal alertness that never relaxed. He knew now why Prince always seemed to shed about 10 years when they made their landfall." And then later on, he says, "The responsibility was his now. If they were challenged now, he must decide if he would surrender his ship, if his men would die defending it. If he lost a man, he must answer the faces on the wharf when he returned." So now he understood, because he now had that responsibility. He understood why Captain Prince was so serious when he was having to be in charge of all these things, all the decisions he had to make. And just that feeling that he had that first time that he stepped off of the boat after all of this responsibility on the ship, that sense of that weight off of his shoulders. Now he's like, oh, now I get it. Now I understand.
Yeah, I think our kids, as they grow, I know my youngest is 17 in his last semester of Quest, and he's like feeling that it's like, oh, now I understand what my brothers went through when they were this age. Now I understand, you know, I'm getting a glimpse of adulthood. I'm being able to see things from other people's perspectives, which that's something he really needed to learn. So that is really cool. So is there any other things in your discussions of this book that you really feel is really important to bring up?
For me, I think it's that the scholars usually bring it up, because in every case, I've never had a colloquium on Carry On, Mr. Bowditch that I didn't have at least one or two scholars, usually more, bring up this incident where I think it's Lem, and he's kind of the way they paint his character, Lem on the ship, he's kind of this, oh gosh, I'm lacking words, Cassie, help me out. He's kind of this kind of big,
rough, like rough around the edges, gruff, big guy.
Yeah, but he's kind of like the football jock kind of character that people look at him like, you're just stupid, but you're strong and you can boss your way around and you can knock
people
down.
Yeah, he's kind
down.
of arrogant, I feel, you know, when I was listening to the book, because I was listening to it again on Audible this time around, and he does kind of come off as a very arrogant, you know it all, like, I know more than, you know, what's going on here, you're just getting in my way kind of thing. That's kind of how I got from it when I read it this time around.
Yeah. And I think that, and I wish I could find it in the book, but there's an incident where he gets a little real with Nat. He gets very real with Nathaniel. And he comes to him kind of when the other men aren't looking, and he asks Nat, do you think you could teach me? Could you teach me this navigation? And you know, what is it? He says something about how, could you teach me without yelling at me, or I can't remember the word he used, but bawling me out, I think was the expression he used, without bawling me out. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes, but only if you're not bawling yourself out. Because he could see that Lem believed that he was stupid, you know, and he was always punishing himself. He was bawling himself out. And I think it's interesting that without fail, the scholars bring that up and how important that is to them. That speaks to them that, you know, if you're thinking that you can't do something, or you're telling yourself that you're stupid, then it's probably going to be very hard for you to learn. And I think the scholars relate to that because a lot of times they feel inadequate. And particularly with Pyramid Project, we're really challenging them in a lot of different ways. They're transitioning into an apprentice level of a scholar. And before that, they were just practicing being a scholar. They were practice scholars. Now they're transitioning, and we raise the bar. We challenge them in a lot of ways. And there are a lot of kids that come into it's like, well, I'm not very good at math. I'm bad at math. I mean, they have this mindset, you know, we talk about mindset. They have this mindset that they're just naturally bad at math, and it's going to be hard for them. And so reading this book, they see themselves in Lem a little bit. And that means something to them. I think a lot of these things that are powerful messages, most of the time the scholars, they see that, and that they can see the importance of the concept or the principle there. And it helps, it inspires them.
Yeah.
One of the things, if the scholars don't bring up, which sometimes they do, because, you know, we ask them to kind of annotate and underline words and phrases, but if they don't bring up, you know, during the colloquium, then we do bring up the nautical terms and metaphors that are used in the book, because I think a lot of them, you know, are very important for them to kind of at least walk away with, and also applying them to themselves. So, you know, some of the nautical terms, the sailing by ash breeze, right? That's referenced throughout the entire book. Being becalmed, right? And so, and then lost his anchor to windward. So we bring out those three things, especially, we want to make sure that the scholars are kind of understanding them if they don't already bring them up. Sometimes they do, sometimes they'll bring up one, but not all three. But we bring those up because a lot of the metaphors that are used kind of describe Nat's character development throughout the book, and how he overcomes certain obstacles, and how he's able to move forward. Like when he gets indentured for 9 years and he feels that maybe he's, you know, that he is becalmed, right? And that he can't go anywhere, and there's nothing else that he can do because he's a bookkeeper and he can't leave his post, you know? And so we talk about this with the scholars, but then at the very end of the book, Nat says something where he's like, I was never becalmed, you know, because he was always moving forward. He was always kind of sailing by ash breeze. And so, you know, we ask the scholars, what does this mean in terms to themselves? How can they apply these terms to their own lives? You know, and what does it mean for them? And so that's another way that we help them work towards other perspectives, you know, with themselves, with each other, but also through that process of self-discovery, using Nat's character development throughout the book.
I love that.
Great.
Yeah.
One of the things that I usually try to ask the scholars as far as this book, and it helps to get them thinking a little bit more deeply, I will ask them, if Nat had actually been able to go to Harvard, which was his dream that he had from the beginning, would he have been able to accomplish what he did? Would it have been different? Would he have been able to accomplish that going to Harvard? I mean, we don't know because he didn't go to Harvard. So it's not like they can answer the question wrong. You know, there's no one right answer, but it's just good to get them thinking, you know, would it maybe have been different? Would he have been able to come up with this? I don't remember. I never can remember the name of it, the navigation, not an almanac, but which is still used today, right? And he corrected much of what was wrong in the one that was being used before that, and everyone counted on it. And he found all these mistakes in it. But would he have been able to accomplish that if he had gone to Harvard? What would have been different in his life if he had gone to Harvard and he hadn't been indentured, or if he hadn't been on a ship ever?
Yeah.
I love that question. We asked the same thing too. It's in my notes right here. I was looking at, if Nat had gone to Harvard, how would things be different? Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you know, we asked that to the scholars. And then we also asked them if they've ever felt that way, if they've ever felt that they wanted to take a different course, but couldn't because something was out of their control. And it's, again, just those self-discovery type of questions where they can apply the character to themselves. But I love that you brought that up, Camille, because we asked that exact same question to them.
Yeah. Well, I like that you took it further, you know, and asking them to be able to apply. It's like, have you ever felt like you were, like you didn't get to do it this way? Your life took a different direction. And when you ask questions like that, those are the ones where a lot of times they will not respond out loud. And that's okay, because they're thinking deeply about their own life. And it's not a rhetorical question, because, you know, when something's a rhetorical question, we don't answer those either. But these are deep, deep questions. And they're good for the kids to ponder. You know, they don't have to share out loud any of those things, because that's a private thing, isn't it? A lot of times.
Yeah. And we'll ask them to journal it too. So some of these questions, you know, in their commonplace book, we'll ask them to kind of journal their thoughts to these. Yeah, absolutely. But then there are some that want to share, and they want to, you know, tell their whole life story. And that's okay too, right? But yeah, we definitely encourage them to ponder it and to journal it.
Yeah. When mentors are preparing for a colloquium with this book, how is it different being a LEMI mentor, being a mentor, than not being one? What is the difference in, you know, how you approach it, how you are thinking about it?
Heidi, I'm not sure, but I think I know where you're going with this, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but And I'm not saying that all, I'm not saying at all that all conveyor belt schools are like this and that all teachers in a public school system are like this, but my children, a lot of them have had experiences with teachers that teach in a way that it's like, I want you to give an expected answer. And even with a book report, they'll give them an outline that is so ridiculously detailed that there's no room for their thoughts. It's all very clearly that they're going to fill in the blanks with what the teacher thinks should go in the blank. And I think it all boils down to getting them to think and to learn how to think. We don't want to just teach, we don't want to tell them what they're supposed to think. We want them to start actually doing thinking, right? And so to me, that's the biggest difference. What we do to prepare the questions that we prepare before we come into a colloquium and how we approach it should all be about that. Not trying to guide them to think what we thought about the book, even if it was fantastic. I had great thoughts about this book, you know, but what did they think, and getting them to think. So to me, that's the difference. I don't know if that's what you were.
Yeah, actually, that's it. Yeah, Cassie, did you have something?
No, I was just going to say, yeah, I think that's exactly what I was going to say. But also, just to add to that, that it boils down, and I've already mentioned this, and I know Camille has too, but, you know, the types of questions that we're asking them, right? With the traditional, you know, conveyor belt type of schooling, or, you know, the questions, you know, might be different as opposed, you know, they might be, all right, how old was Nat when he was indentured? Where did Nat grow up? Where did, right? It's very multiple choice, very close-ended. They're not open-ended questions at all that allows that free thinking to take place. And even if they are, it might be slightly different, like a fill in the blank of what the teacher wants the students to take away from, instead of that self-discovery and exploration happening with the student themselves. So I think those are the two big differences. I mean, Camille said it, and then I think it's also that the questions are just different themselves, you know, the closed-ended versus the open-ended questions.
Yeah. And I think like in the conveyor belt, like you're saying, like they're looking for reading comprehension and that's it. Mm-hmm. And besides getting them to like really like think critically, and I think Cassie just kind of touched on this, was like, we're trying to help them to learn how to relate these lessons to themselves and their own lives. We always bring it around to like, not only like, what can we learn from these examples and from people's characteristics and different things, but also how does that apply to your life? And that's what we always do, is just bring it back to them and like, how's this applicable? So I feel like that's what happens a lot in conveyor belt, is that it's reading comprehension. It doesn't apply to my life. Who cares? Is it just some stupid guy? Whatever, you know? So just trying to help them see and create more of like a pattern in their lives. It's like, how does this apply to me? How can I take these lessons and apply them to my life?
That's beautiful, Leah. I love that, because that we want them to be able to relate something from the book to themselves. You know, why would we think it was a classic if there wasn't some application to their own lives? And so getting them to think more deeply about something, which maybe in their mind it's like more of an opinion, but, you know, I would maybe ask them something about how did Nat try to gain control of a life that he felt like he didn't have any control of? You know, what were the things that he did that helped him? And have you ever felt like you don't really have any choice? You don't have any control over your own life. You know, you just kind of have to go in this particular direction. So what did Nat do to try to find control in his life? You know, for me, that's a really profound question for this book in particular, where we see this young boy, we see young Nathaniel, and he's waiting for the right moment to make this wish or spell or whatever it is. He had this coin. Do you remember that? I hope I'm remembering it right. Right at the beginning of the book, he talks about how he's waiting for this good luck spell. And then he slept through the time. He talks about how his family had all this bad luck. And so he starts out with like leaning on luck and magic spells or whatever, and then, or a good luck spell. And then he goes to like, well, I'm going to buy an expectation and then I can help my family so we're not so poor, right? And then that didn't come through. And so later in the book, I think it's when, because of what happened with the boat that he had invested his expectation in. And again, ladies, correct me if I'm getting this mixed up, but I think it ends up that he actually acquires all of these books that were on this ship. And for him, that was like heaven, right? To have this kind of an expectation. And do we have maybe expectations in our life? We think this is how I want my life to be bettered. And it doesn't happen the way we think it's going to. And Nat had to deal with that all the time. Things were happening that he had no control over. Being sold, indentured, lock, stock, and bookkeeper, as he says, you know, and going to sea and loved ones dying. He didn't have control over those things in his life. So what did he do? What decisions did he make so that he could have a semblance of control over his own life? Those are deep questions, even for grown-ups. You know?
Definitely. Definitely. But like you said earlier, this is a class where we're trying to help them become apprentice scholars, which is kind of moving away from that initiative and towards being able to submit to a mentor. And this is just a fantastic book to help them do that. I mean, talk about submission, how much submission he had to have in while he was indentured, but yet he was still able to take that initiative and learn and do so much. It's a very inspiring book, especially for kids this age, because a lot of kids in, you know, what, 13, 14, 15, they feel like they have no control over their own lives. And so they can really relate a lot to this. So, yeah. So as we kind of wind down, what are some things that you would like to tell mentors who are leading colloquiums? Are there any like tips or tricks or anything else that you would like to share?
Be patient.
Be okay with the uncomfortable silence.
I think we're all going to say like almost the exact same thing. Yeah,
be prepared. Be prepared with good questions that get them thinking, yeah. And don't let them cop out. And by that I mean, one of the things I tell my scholars is that you're not allowed to say, "I don't know. That's not an answer." And they know me well enough by the time we've been together for a few weeks that it's like, if they say, "I don't know," I'll say, "Unacceptable." Think about it till there's something that you know, right? And I try to let them know there's always something they can share. And then try very, very hard to hone the skill of taking whatever a scholar may say in a colloquium, whatever they may share, whatever idea or thought they have, and helping to expand that or to maybe get more discussion about that by asking the group, you know, is there anyone else in here that felt that way when you were reading this book? You know, or how did that part of the book make you feel? You know, so you're helping to kind of keep that discussion going. And I would just say that be okay with the discussion going in a little bit different direction than you may have anticipated. So for instance, one time actually with this book, I had a scholar that they brought up the part in the book early on where Nat's older brother says something to him about how boys don't cry or something like that.
Blubber. They don't blubber.
They don't blubber. Same thing, right? Yeah. And he really took that to heart. He took that to heart. And you see it later in the book a couple of times where he's like, he wasn't going to blubber over this horrible thing that happened to him. You know, nowadays we help our kids express and name their emotions, which I personally feel is healthy. And I remember the first time I read this book thinking that's bad advice to tell boys they shouldn't cry because everyone has emotions and it's okay to express them in a good way. But this was something one of the scholars brought out that they were like, "I didn't like that in the book." Oh, why didn't you like it? You know, and then to be able to talk about, you know, that was a prevalent view in that culture at that time. And do we have that view in our culture now? And, you know, then they're talking, they're discussing something that's important to them that was spurred by reading the book. It maybe wasn't the direction that we all thought the discussion would take, and the whole discussion wasn't spent on that, but your scholars will bring up things that maybe will be unexpected for you.
I think also, especially since we're trying to transition them out of practice scholar, is to make sure that they know there's an expectation that they come prepared with questions, with like quotes or different things to share. And one thing that I have learned is to do that first. Like sometimes I'll get in the habit of like leading the book discussion, but then really letting like their questions and their thoughts lead it first, and to see what they have to say before I try to lead the discussion. If that makes sense.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And validate, because it's just like writing.
That's important.
It's just like writing, sharing their thoughts. They're sharing their thoughts, and so sometimes they might say something and they're afraid to say it, or they don't know if it sounds stupid or not, and then if you don't remember to validate it, or if you just kind of like go with it, then they get insecure. So it's like they're still vulnerable, and it's like they're sharing their thoughts, and they're sometimes afraid to. And so if you just validate whatever they say and try, like Camille said, like try and, you know, like build upon it so that they can see the value of what they had to say, but make sure that they feel validated in what they shared.
And I think that's really important for me. I try to get really clear, and also with my scholars when we have book discussions, because the very first time that I ever mentored anything was Pyramid Project, and it scared the bejeebies out of me just doing it, you know. And I had a great bunch of scholars. We had six girls and six boys, and they always just put themselves on opposite sides of the room. But they all had very strong feelings and opinions about things. And they were, for the most part, not afraid to share it. And sometimes it got kind of argumentative, you know, just disagreeing with each other. So there were a few things that I did. And one was validate, like you said, Leah. You know, for me, even if it's something that I disagree with, I will always just thank them. Thank you for sharing that. That's an interesting, you know, perspective. Or that's, you know, that was something maybe I hadn't thought about. And maybe others in the group thought about it, but I hadn't. Or maybe they hadn't, you know. So just even just thanking them for sharing that is validating. We don't have to validate in the sense of like we totally agree with them. Because when we do that, a lot of times it can become non-validating for some of the other scholars, in that they might think, oh, if the mentor thinks that was a good comment or that was something good, then what I might have to share, they won't like it. So they've already decided that I've judged them differently in their thoughts. So we don't want them to feel like they have to please us in the way that they think. Does that make sense? But just validating in terms of like letting them know that you're grateful that they shared, you know, or that it was something interesting or something that maybe other people hadn't thought about in that way before. And also, I don't necessarily believe in making any place a safe space, in the sense that we hear that nowadays. But the way I like to look at it is, I teach my scholars that when they're in our pyramid class, this is meant to be a respectful space. And regardless of what other people may think, we can disagree with them, but we are going to be respectful towards one another. And that helped me so much with my first class, because I had these very intelligent, outspoken, strong opinioned scholars who would often disagree with each other and, you know, would stand up and like pound the pulpit and say, "No, this is how it is." You know, I had to sometimes remind them, this is a respectful space. This is how we do things when we're here. We always respect each other, regardless of whether we agree with the other person or not.
Well, we are out of time. Thank you so much, ladies. I really appreciate you being here and talking about this amazing book and sharing how to run a colloquium. So many great insights.
It was great being here, Heidi.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode.
Just as in every LEMI training, we hope you walk away uplifted and inspired, but also empowered to be a better mentor for your family and your community.
Please be sure to subscribe and share.
We also want to express our gratitude to all the LEMI mentors, past and present.
You got this. You can do hard things.